And about, I think we are live. Okay, hi again, everyone, and hi, Blaine. How are you doing?
Fantastic. Happy to be here.
Yeah, it's good to see you again. We were just reminiscing in a room right now that it's almost been a year exactly since we last spoke because you were at Emacs Conf last year.
That's right. This is great all right, fun.
Thank you for coming in, and especially every time you come with a very well-crafted talks, talking about, you know, what you do with org mode, org roam, and whatever. And it's really fascinating as someone who develops and uses those tools constantly to see you put them in action so well, because you know, the way you talk about your research, it really reminds me on what we were, sorry, I've got elves talking in my ears and I'm still not used to it at this point, but it's really nice to see you put all of this together into a very cohesive way for you to write. Okay, let me just share my screen and I'll be sharing the questions. Where is it? Right, take presenter. And I will be sharing the questions. All right. Can you see my screen all right?
I can, yes.
Okay, cool. So we'll move straight to the question. Let me just check on the time. I think we have about until 10:20, which is in 17 minutes. So let's take about 10 to 15 minutes of question time. And if people have joined on BBB, we'll also be taking questions live. All right. Starting with the first question, what does 0573 mean in your init file name?
So this name is, you can think of it as a prefix or a stub. It's an index number that I utilize before a short name that describes the project. So I have all my projects in my home directory, and I just start typing the project number or index number in the terminal, and I have auto completion available through OMYZSH package. So I just hit tab and it auto completes the name of the project and pops me into that folder. And so I find this to be very easy for navigating between projects. As you saw, I work on multiple projects in a given day, and this helps me move about. And I also use this number as at the start of the log file name and at the start of the manuscript name and the start of the, I also have an annotated bibliography. So all those files are identified just in case I accidentally save one to the wrong folder. I can sort them out later. Great question. Thank you.
Yeah. Next question, which I think is it's going to be a long one. What does Zettelkast mean?
So this is, means like, I guess, note box, something along those lines. You can think of it as
a box, usually, that's the word we use.
Thank you. So this is a kind of like a card catalog system that when it was done on paper, and now it's being done electronically through various software packages. So in the Emacs world, org roam is one of several alternate packages that you can use. Prot has Denote, and there's a couple others. So the idea is that you create a note, usually ultimately what you want to do is create a nugget of knowledge from your reading that you've done, and you want to you add it to this note system and in such a way that you can recover it more easily than what had to be done in the old days with index cards. So you set up backlinks, and then you have you can use the search features in org roam to filter and find these the notes again in the future. Org roam has a wonderful GUI interface where you can display it as a knowledge graph, essentially all your nodes and the backlinks between them. I set mine up in a rather hierarchical fashion at least right now, it's pretty hierarchical at this point, but it may become more disorganized over time. But it's, I find it, I'm sort of a visual person. I like mind maps a lot. I find that this visual display of my Zettelkasten is similar, resembles a certain degree a mind map.
Okay, well, that's pretty good. Pretty good definition of what Zettelkasten is, and you also went on to specify it what it means inside Emacs. So thank you. I think that clarifies it for the two people in the room who still do not know after attending four Emacs Conf. So what is the Zettelkasten method? moving on to the next question: how many papers are you writing at the same time? Because I believe you mentioned that you had concurrent papers being written during your presentation.
So I'm probably working on in a given year somewhere between 10 and 15. How many do I get published in a year? Probably anywhere from 1 to 4 or 5. so these papers often, the work on them spans multiple years, and I will start working on a paper when I before I begin the experiments, ideally, because I'm trying to do hypothesis-driven research. So that helps define the scope of the project and limit the number of rabbit holes I go down. Due to the nature of the work, there's a lot of waiting required, in my case, for crystals to grow and then the opportunity to collect diffraction data on the crystals. And then the structures have to be determined and refined and analyzed and then deposited. Figures have to be made. So a lot of steps are involved that those take generally span. That work can span several years. In a given day, I try to work on two papers, ideally. I haven't been doing so well lately over the past month, but I had in the past year, there was a couple days where I worked on five papers. There was something like a half dozen where I worked on four, about 40 days where I worked on three. And I think there was something like about 100 days where I worked on two papers a day, and about 140 days where I just worked on one. But so my ideas that I've been sort of developing more recently is that I'll start doing like the generative writing on a paper at the beginning of the day on the project I'm most excited about. I'm a night owl. I try to do this work early in the morning when I'm half awake to try to overcome my internal editor that inhibits me from writing prose freely. And so the idea is just to get a lot of words out, worry about editing them later. And then after about 3 hours, I'll switch to the second project that I'm less excited about, and I can go for another 90 minutes to 2 hours on that project. So I build up a lot of momentum, and then I do the switch, and I find that switch to be relatively easy. You know, so my process will be on project A, make some final notes about what was accomplished in the writing log. Then I'll switch over to the writing log for the project B, and I'll go to the diary section at the beginning. I'll make some, make a little to-do list, and maybe look at the prior entry in the diary to if I need to reboot my memory, and then I'll move on to the manuscript and go for 90 minutes or 2 hours. Generally, you're only good for somewhere between 4.5 and 5.5 hours. If you try to write in a generative fashion much longer than that, your productivity goes down quite a bit. You're better off switching to a completely different activity and then using your experience doing that writing to essentially launch background jobs in your subconscious. And so you will get those ideas in the shower the next morning.
I find it's really funny because I also relate. I've also worked a lot on organization as linked to paper writing, but also to on my work as a developer. And it's funny how you refer to your ability to think about something in very similar terms to how a computer would think about something. You've mentioned in your presentation the cost of context switching between different things, but it's also something that we use in computing when a processor needs to be thinking about something else. Well, it has a cost. And it's really fun for me to hear you talk about, I need to select two topics, but no longer than 90 minutes per topic, because it's really about maximizing your output for creativity. And overall, your entire chat, your entire presentation here is about really maximizing the engagement that you have between outputs and your cognition. And I really find this amazing how down to the T you've managed to do this. And it actually leads me to another question, which is being asked of you, which is, how do you capture those IDs when you are away from Emacs? And perhaps not only those you have in the showers, but also elsewhere.
So that's a great question. Over the past year, last January, upon recommendation of a senior colleague, I bought a digital voice recorder for $85 from Sony. And it's the best investment I've made in a very long time, other than my laptop computer, because I then record my thoughts. So I have a half hour commute, and to me, that's largely a waste of time. I wish I'd lived a lot closer to work, but I use that time to generate ideas. So maybe I'll start my day at home for 90 minutes, I worked on paper A, and then I might try to prime my mind about project B, or I might still have ideas that are flowing about project A, and I'll record those in the digital voice recorder. And then when I get to the lab, I'll transfer the audio file to my computer and I'll transcribe it using Whisper. So I've set up some Python scripts and Bash functions to go through, and I convert all the sentences into one sentence per line, because that's the way I like to write and edit things. And so it does all this pre-processing for me, and I have this transcript that's in pretty good shape. I don't have to do very much editing. And I'll then copy that over and work on it, clean it up, and pluck out the ideas that I think might be useful. Unfortunately, I'm not very, I'm not away from my computer that much. I'm in front of it, 12, 14 hours a day. So when I'm teaching, when I'm in seminar, other committee meetings, traveling, then, I'll capture ideas on paper. I don't have a cell phone. I'm trying to be the last human on earth without a cell phone. I think I would be so distracted by a cell phone, I would be the worst person on the planet. I would be totally focused on my cell phone if I had one. So I'm one of the few people left who can read a map. So I do run into some difficulties hailing taxis and that sort of thing when I'm traveling. So there are some downsides to not having a cell phone, but these days.
Yeah, but I think there's a pretty significant upside, because you talk about cell phones here, but before you were talking about the 90 minutes of uninterrupted focus on a given topic, and I think plenty of people would be envious of this ability to focus for that long on a topic. And I guess if we are to thread the needle here, well, the lack of cell phone might be for something, for this ability to focus. So take of this what you will.
True. I do have, I am a sucker for, the web browser. I can get distracted going down various rabbit holes, thanks to Google searches and that sort of thing. Likewise, email is another attention grabber. So there's those other battles I have to fight too. That is a huge battle that all of us face is developing focus and being able to maintain focus.
So. Right. So we have about three more minutes of questions. So thank you so much already for answering many questions. How about we do a quick fire for the remaining questions, and then maybe we'll take a question from here or in the room. So how about we go for the next one? What if an ID does not belong to any current working manuscript?
So I have a sandbox area in the log file. So if it's likely going to be related to something to a certain degree. If the idea is totally unrelated to anything I'm working on, then I will I maintain a 750 words. I maintain a kind of a external diary, and I just capture those kind of ideas there. So I have access through a web interface to this big text area with nothing in it, and I just dump ideas all day long in there. So and I save that away. I have that in a big LaTeX document currently on Overleaf, where each day has its own page, and so that information is captured and I can recover it. And maybe it's going to take me a week, a month, a year to take that idea and think about it, and then eventually I'll get to a point where I have a critical mass of momentum and data and so forth, where I can start a new writing project. But you're right, that is a problem, capturing those ideas and keeping track of them. The Zettelkasten can also help with that.
Right. Okay, so we have time for one more question, and I think I'm going to skip this one. You can take all the time you want after we're done with the live show for you to answer in BBB, obviously, and even after the conference. But I'd really like to finish on this one. So if there were one habit from your process, referencing your extensive flowchart, that you want active learners or professional researchers to adopt, which would it be and why?
So I think just keeping that daily diary, that's the essential part for overcoming the fear of forgetting and the fear of losing momentum. One reason why people don't work on two projects a day is that they fear losing momentum on the first project they're working on. And but we often are stuck with working on multiple writing projects, and they're best done over longer periods of time rather than in a hasty fashion. I try to avoid binge writing, although I do my share of that too.
Okay, well, Blaine, thank you so much for all your questions. The stream is going to move to the next talk. Sorry, I keep mistaking chat and talk. We're moving to the next talk of the day, but feel free to stay in a room. For everyone interested in asking more questions to Blaine, the Big Blue Button link is available on the website. You can join and ask questions directly to Blaine. And otherwise, we'll make sure that all the remaining questions on the pad get their answer eventually. Thank you so much, Blaine.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, I think the stream is moving on. Just making sure. Okay, yes, we are moving on to the next stream. So Blaine, I'm going to need to get ready for the next talk. So thank you so much for all your answers, and feel free to answer your questions. And I'm sorry that I didn't get to field your question live. It's just there was a lot of questions.
It's fine. It was not a question, actually. It was a comment.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I would love to hear the comment.
Yeah. You mentioned about that you sit all the day in front of computer, right? And I have to say, it's not too different from a mobile phone if you get distracted by web browser. I also have the same problem. And one interesting solution I found at some point is that I prime my mind about a certain task. I leave my office and I go for a walk while thinking about this. And that really forces to focus, because while you're walking, you have nothing else to do. You cannot go at go like search in Google and stuff like that. It can really help in some cases.
I try to periodically I'll try to take the restart doing the Pomodoro method, where you're supposed to get up every 25 minutes and take a break. But that requires a lot of discipline, and it also has I find I'm more exhausted if by following that method at the end of the day. But I think the problem with, well, I think in part.
No, I don't mean Pomodoro, actually. I mean more like shower thoughts. Because when you take shower, you think about something, right?
Right.
When you just go for a walk, you again think about something. This is not a break to take rest. It's a break to think away from computer.
You prime yourself, your brain, by picking something that works.
So basically, I have a project. I think certain questions I want to think about. I sometimes take my like piece of paper with me, and then when I walk, I like take notes. You can record voice in your case, and like half an hour, and you can really generate ideas.
I have been doing a similar thing. I'll take a clipboard. Maybe I'll have some blank pages where I'll jot down ideas as I walk. I'll go for like a half hour, hour long walk, and I'll also read papers sometimes. And in the process of reading, I get ideas. The clipboard, though, is socially less acceptable. It reminds people of their gym teacher, I think, or their Marine drill sergeant. And they give me all kinds of weird looks, even though they're walking and reading their cell phone, looking down at their cell phone. They look, give me weird looks for looking down at a clipboard as I walk. So there's that weird aspect to it. It's kind of hilarious. Thank you very much for the comment.
Hopefully it's helpful, because I really struggled a lot with the browser in the past, not so much these days.
Very good. That's good to hear.
I asked when I write notes, I've noticed, like with the getting things done and the Zettelkastens, I like to separate them out. And beyond that, I also like to separate them out on daily things and global things. So that, for instance, your Zettelkasten, a daily would be like a journal. If you separate it out, it gives a lot of tension of, if it's just a stray thought, I'll write it into my journal if I don't know where it goes. If I can think of a permanent place for it to go, it goes into the Zettelkasten. Same thing with getting things done. It's like, you start with like a fresh sheet of paper every single day or note or whatever. You have tricks like that that you've noticed?
So I'm sort of doing something similar through this. To be honest, at the start of the day, I actually will just do sort of a brain dump of what happened the day before, just to try to get writing it again. And these days, because of carpal tunnel syndrome, I'll use a voice speech to text to generate that initial text. And I'm just trying to build up momentum of generating words. And so I capture, but I'm also adding to that document throughout the day. And so that it's available through the web browser. I have a tab open to 750 words all the time. There's an alternate to it that is called Write Honey, that somebody in Berlin started. Because they have benefited so greatly from this practice. They have made it available for free, apparently for life. And so there's no word limit, whereas I have a grandfathered version of 750 words, and I have a word limit of 5,000 words. I rarely hit it, but it's nice to know that Write Honey doesn't have that limit. So that's how I'm capturing things. And then so some of that text winds up being moved into my log file, or even sometimes into the manuscript. So maybe a little less organized than the getting things done approach with the dailies and then the refiling process. So I don't do any refiling. I want to file once. I don't want to file a second time, or you know, have to go back and file, handle something a second time. So that's my rationale for the approach I take.
I'm not using it. I've had various iterations of systems I've used, but I think my favorite one for like getting things done is actually not using Arc Agenda, just like making a blank sheet and kind of doing like a template where it's just like, and separating my tasks out into three categories, like core tasks, like, and rule of thumb is like, if it's beyond three, it's too many. And like core tasks, secondary tasks, and unplanned tasks. So those three categories. So like, for instance, a core task, if it's greater than three, it's too many. That way is like, when you look back, then you can see, like, if I got my core tasks done, I did really good. Or if I got a lot of secondary tasks, but not my core tasks done, I got sidetracked with things that don't matter. If I got a lot of unplanned tasks, I could look at those unplanned tasks to see, oh yeah, okay, that was fine. Okay, the day didn't go as planned, but it was, yeah.
That's an excellent suggestion. I generally just too long of a to-do list. It's impossible to accomplish in a day.
Then I just like, for instance, another trick that I liked was I also put like that under like a week, because it makes more sense to do it under a week, and then I'd have like subheadings under that, like, you know, so week, day, then I'd have those three categories for each of the tasks, and then kind of as an unofficial day at the end, I just like have a staging area for all tasks. So I just kind of, and then I want to be using Org Agenda. So then I'd just be moving up and down, you know, because you're able to rearrange stuff in org mode so easily. There's a good way of, that's been my favorite iteration of doing it.
So I've had, I wrote a little function that pops in the to-dos in my, that are specific to a particular project in the log file for that project. And then I add the log file name to the list of org files that Org Agenda searches. So those to-dos will show up. But my list is too long and that becomes overwhelming. So I'll just assign a to-do heading to the top item in my to-do list to try to, but maybe I should be three. That'd be reasonable compromise. That's a good idea. But so you're doing weekly planning then?
I can show up. What ended up making me stop is I didn't know how to make a template of it, and I ended up getting annoyed by manually changing the days every single time and naming like my files and stuff like that. If I did it now, I could figure out how to program it, or if I spent enough time, but that's what I think eventually made me stop doing it.
So there's you could make a snippet for the week, and then you could have code in the snippet that would generate the dates automatically. So I have, like, for my daily entry, I have a snippet called entry, and then I hit tab and or control O, whatever, to insert the snippet, and that has the current date already entered. So I skip that, I don't have to deal with that. So I think you could probably feed the task, what you want to accomplish to Copilot, for example, or Bing Copilot. I've been using Bing Copilot for the past 3 or 4 months to return ELISP code that works 90% of the time. I've been pretty impressed, and it's free. So no API key required. It's just go, it runs. So I guess I installed the Bing Copilot plugin in the Google Chrome, and that's what I've been using.
Yeah, I can show you my screen if you want to see what like the screen looks like. I can email you the template or the I kind of have it saved as a template. I gotta find it though. Let's see. Not exactly set up to. All right, so. I don't know if you can see this well enough, but yeah, let's make it bigger. Can you see that at all?
I can see a little bit of it. Yeah, it's kind of blurry.
All right, well, but then you just do that right there. So
it's all color coded. So I get a sense of what the kind of greenish blue lines must be. What days, I guess, or.
Okay, well, right there is like, so you can see like startup show two levels, then I have like numbers right there. So right on one day you have like the core tasks, there's 3 out of 4 done. Then I have like secondary and unplanned, and then yeah, that's just the general idea. Let's see.
So this is you raise, you know, the sort of the dilemma I face, of course, is that I have trying to maintain like a to-do list and or project specific, and then there's the all the other things I have to do, and so there should be like some the org agenda should be a way of being able to pull the two sets together, I guess. I had broken up my I had way too many to-do lists stored in various places, and so that's the problem, I guess, when you have too many to-dos and the org agenda becomes overwhelming, and it sort of discourages me.
Yeah, I figure that the general task on that is like I start writing things up, I get more and more items. Oh, I'll make a master to-do list. Oh, my master to-do list has too many items. Let me throw it out.
Well, there's another name for that kind of list. You could, call it a grass catcher list. Charles Hobbs was this, he wrote a book in the 80s called Time Power. And he had so he was one of these time management gurus, and let's see, get the name of some like Tony Robbins, and forget the name of the other guy, that's Brian Tracy. So that they have kind of pushed the same kind of similar approaches, but Charles Hobbs had a very more organized approach, I think, and more disciplined. And he identified that kind of list as a grass catcher list, where you have a list of items that, you know, you think you might want to do, but you haven't prioritized them yet. And you haven't scheduled them yet, but they need a safe place to be stored. And, when time permits, the idea was you would pull items off that grass catcher list and move it into a to-do item that you will schedule and commit to getting done.
That was the idea, like separating them between like core tasks, secondary tasks, unplanned tasks, because your whole day can't be planned.
Right, right. You have things you have to do that are unscheduled that come through your door or land in your inbox or land in your email. You've got to do them. Mm-hmm.
And then core tasks, I don't know, like to-do lists, their whole point is. So for instance, like Journal and Zettelkasten, and they're kind of, and like this global list versus the daily list, they're kind of done a little differently. With Zettelkasten, it's like organic, things build up, if you make a note, it's great. If you don't, if it has a small amount, that's great. Have a small note. With like a daily to-do, you want to use it to like make decisions. So that's like kind of like the idea of having the core task and the secondary task separate, because the whole thing about it is I want to use this to eliminate what I'm going to do. It's to choose what I'm going to do, like the core tasks. Because if I can get my core tasks, I can be happy with my previous days. And then I would probably start using agenda a lot more if I was more consistent with using like these as like weekly files. I don't know. But then the whole goal thing is just like, let me see what I want to populate the day list with.
So how many core tasks wind up spanning multiple days because they're just such big projects?
I would need more time using the system before I'd figure something like that out. As I said, like I'm not using it right now, but that has been my favorite iteration of using these.
So within the core tasks, do you assign like priorities? So way I would translate this a little bit would be like in this method that Charles Hobbs had. He had a kind of a category for the items that you really have to get done, and they're really important, and so they're like they get a priority of A, and then the secondary cat task would get a priority of B, but then within the A category you would number them like 1 through 3, I guess.
All right, so this would be part of the purpose of separating the daily list or like the weekly list from the global list. So for instance, your global list, you'd say, I want this project that will take a long duration of time, but your daily list would just say, I want to work on it today, even if I don't get it done today. Like I want to work on it today. Then maybe you can link your daily list to that global list, or you know, something along those lines. But that would be, I think, a good answer to that type of problem, because the daily list is like supposed to be for that day, not for, like, for instance, you start out clean, you make the list, like that would probably be your first task for the week, is what do I want for the week? Then you have some tasks that you do with staging. And then like, for instance, since you look at it as a whole week at a time, you're able to rearrange it and say, these are the things I want to get done this week. This is what I really want to get done on this day. This is what I don't care about on this day.
Another person that kind of, and this is kind of related, there was this idea of time blocking. So obviously, three tasks, core tasks, maybe they're going to take 3 or 4 hours each, or 2 or 3. And you can assign blocks of time in your schedule to get them done. And often what happens is they take longer than you expect, and you have to extend the blocks. But Calvin Newport has that's a kind of approach he advocates, is and I think the power to that is you're mapping out, you know, you're allocating the time to do these things, and you're seeing how much time things actually take, and then you wind up adjusting in the future. And the idea is with his approach is do it on paper, and then you have to, like, if something takes longer, that pushes everything else down. You just wind up redrawing your schedule for the day manually. And so it's kind of laborious, and that labor is supposed to inhibit you from spending too much time on a project, because you know you got the pain of redrawing everything if you spend too much on time on the first project.
Yeah, there was it's whatever strategy you want to do. Like, for instance, to me, it's like doing it this way makes me say, I want to focus on like what matters. It'll tell me if I feel good about that day. Depends on what algorithm, what level and what type of strategy you're using. If you're using time blocking, you're optimizing for each level of time block, whereas like this, and you can combine the approaches, it'd be trickier. But like, now let's see. I was listening to a talk with Jordan Peterson. One of the things he said that really resonated with me is like, you want to use a calendar, but the first rule of using a calendar is don't let the calendar tyrannize you. Because like the first thing you want to do whenever you use a calendar is schedule every single minute of the day. Now you don't have any room for if any task overruns at all. And after a couple of tests, you're like, I don't want to do this anymore. I rebel. I'm going to throw it out.
So one kind of combination is through this Pomodoro method I mentioned earlier, where you would sort of like block out, say, 2 hours. You work for like 25 minutes, take a little break for up to 5 minutes and get back to work. And then after 2 hours, you're to take like a 15-minute break in the morning. In the afternoon, you might even let that break run longer, and you might only have 3 work sessions between breaks. So because you're going to be more run down in the afternoon. And so you build in some into your schedule some flex, like, okay, that's supposed to be a break time, but maybe some urgency comes up and you got to deal with, and you have to break out of this Pomodoro technique. So that's one way of kind of scheduling in some flexibility is through the breaks. Peterson's right. Boy, I don't schedule to that kind of detail. That's just too oppressive.
Well, neither do I, but it's like that. Like I don't try to. To me, the much more interesting question that I try to do is like, let's try to make sure I do the important things, because if I do those, my life will probably move a lot quicker. If I choose a couple items that I really want and am able to consistently do them, I think my life would drastically start improving. Not necessarily if I can play the game of optimizing every hour.
You're right.
Maybe that could be, and it's a place to start rather, and I think it'd be the most effective place to start. And if I got better at using it all the time, perhaps I'd be playing optimizing every hour game. But this is the game I think would be best bang for buck for me to optimize now.
Yeah, what you're trying to optimize for is accomplishing these core tasks, getting them done and as quickly as possible, or, as effectively as possible, and as effectively as you need, or whatever your goal is. But focusing on that rather than the scheduling, I think.
Plus, like a core task could be, I don't know, like catch up on all my house chores or do a specific one if it's really big, or like, I don't know, it's whatever you want it to be. It's like you can make them bigger or smaller depending on how you word them and everything. Because like if you say capture all of your house chores up, for like 1 week and you haven't done anything, that's probably a little too ambitious.
That's right. Yeah, well, a lot of, I spend, I don't know, at least 15 minutes, half an hour at the beginning of the day, sort of my planning and sort of my initial writing session is involves a bit of planning. And there's always a lot more time. So generally, depending on the nature of your work, it can take up to 15% of your time. It can take quite a bit of time. And I think people don't I really acknowledge that as part of your work is planning, and it can take a significant amount of time.
Oh yeah, that's what I was meaning though. It was like the very first thing I think people generally always try to do with the calendar is like, look at how productive I can be. Let's schedule every single minute up. And it's like, you're not going to want to do that for very long, and it's not going to work out. Yeah, and what you were saying about the Pomodoro technique, one of the core, one of the benefits could be described of another benefit I've seen of like multiple habits books is if you start multiple small habits where you try to do them consistently, you give yourself an opening to where if you get into the flow state, you can do a lot more of it. Like, let's say you got a habit of, just write a journal entry. Well, you're a journal entry of like at least two lines. That could very easily turn to like three paragraphs. And if you have like a whole bunch of like the Pomodoro technique, it could be like stubs to allow you to do more stuff. Where the to allow you to generate inspiration and then capture it when it strikes, if the mood fancies you.
So that's kind of an issue with the Pomodoro technique. Idea is that you just, if you really have to break out because the idea is too big to put on the back burner and hold in place, then you do have to break out of the Pomodoro and go, jot down a quick note or three paragraphs.
But like how
and
much
you don't get to count that as a Pomodoro, you have to like reset your count because you've broken it. According to that method, it's kind of rigid.
It's a different algorithm optimizing for different things, and this may just be like a byproduct, but this could be very easily like a core advantage that may or may not be like the core reason that you were using it but didn't realize it, and may not be something that it's optimizing for.
So are you developing like a Emacs package then with your template?
No, as I said, my next steps where I think would make it work a lot better is if I figured out some way of like automatically filling out the dates or maybe automatically adding the file per week into an out of org agenda. Like that would be like my next steps. I think if I did that, it would have a much greater chance of becoming part of my workflow at all times.
Yeah, I bet you could do it pretty get something like that to work with the help of Copilot. I'm not a wizard yet at Emacs Lisp, but I find that Copilot's quite helpful.
Yeah, their AIs are definitely interesting.
So, do you ever use any LaTeX inside of org mode?
No, mostly because I know that like I could try to learn it, but I just don't have a need for it. So,
yeah.
And then also like, I remember learning when I learned HTML, I like writing HTML more than for instance Word, because it was a lot more transparent, like a plain text document is, and kind of wrote the ordered list, unordered list in such a way that it kind of looked similar to the page. But I find that I like org mode more than HTML because, well, it's optimized for like my writing and consumption and overall use case rather than like optimizing it for somebody else to view, which I generally don't have as much. But So like, I don't know, Orgmo is what I'm going to end up using the most. So I just want to use LaTeX enough. Although I'd be interested in learning LaTeX snippets inside of org mode for like the math stuff, but then again, I just never have to type it.
So my attitude towards org mode changed radically over the summer. I was avoiding it somewhat before, and then when I realized I could, you know, I can keep all of all the great aspects of LaTeX and still use all the great features of org mode. So I view now, I think of org mode as a wrapper around LaTeX. I know it's not really that, but by thinking about it that way, it's much more palatable to me to just go commit to doing as much as possible in org mode. So that's what I've been doing this fall. It's just every document I start is an org file.
I imagine I would like it if I knew it. It's just because I imagine it would feel to me like HTML, where it's just like, yeah, I can write it. I can format it the way I want to. This is just guesses from my experience with HTML. I can read the source code of it and kind of get an idea of how it will look like. But it's like if you're going to use like the Linux terminal, but you're going to use it for like an hour a week an hour a week. It's just like, it's just not enough time to dedicate to learn it for it to start paying off.
That's right. And you can always export your org file to an HTML file.
Yeah.
But the org file is what I stare at, you know, 95% of the time or more. I want to use the PDF. So I export to PDF generally. And when I export to, you know, HTML, it's very cool. I like looking at the document in the web browser. I like navigating it. But I generally will export it to a PDF so I can print it out when I'm traveling to carry out editing. And but that's, you know, just a small tiny fraction of the time that I'm actually working with the document. So most of the time it's in org mode. You know, maybe it doesn't look as pretty as in, you know, HTML, but it's it's so such a pleasure to work in because of the way you can reorder lists, you know, create headlines so simply.
What about org mode versus markdown? Because I know when I looked at org mode versus markdown, it's like, yeah, more stuff supports markdown, but org mode has like more stuff built into it, like the calendar and agenda stuff, and it's obvious what this is supposed to be in org mode, and it's got the best, and Emacs has got the best client. I use Emacs, and I think it's got a better syntax than markdown. Like, you got stuff like Obsidian and Notes and what about like the markdown?
So markdown is, I use it a lot on GitHub repositories for the README files. You know, sometimes I'll do them in org, but generally just go with the GitHub markdown. But the like tables are still kind of a pain in markdown, whereas tables are such a pleasure to build in org mode because you have that dynamic adjusting of the column width as you enter, make entries that become wider, and it's so easy to add columns, and it's so hard to add columns, and it's much harder in markdown and in LaTeX. It's more of a pain to add new columns. The table aspect, that to me was one of the killer features. And then the other killer feature, of course, is the literate programming or interactive programming. So interactive computing that you can do where you have a code block and then you can execute it and have the output show up right below the code block. And and org mode's support for that kind of interactive computing is, I'm not aware of anything more sophisticated, because you could have parallel sessions. You got four Python sessions going, each of them labeled differently, and they're all walled off from each other. They don't see each other. Or you can have different programming languages. So you can do polyglottic programming, where you have maybe Python's generating a table, and then that table gets, you decide you want to plot it using R. Well, you want to use ggplot2 and R to plot it. So you, that table gets fed into R in the next code block down, and then below it, you get a graph made in R, or you can make it in nuplot, or you could, or some other, or you could move it into a LaTeX code block and plot the data in with a TXZ, or was it or TIX, T-I-K-Z. Or you could move it into Clojure and use one of the Clojure plotting programs. Just kind of limitless what you can do in terms of recombining the best of different programming languages.
Yeah, let's see. The literate DevOps are really good talks and subjects to get into this type of stuff. And like they give a very good example of like of some tips on how to do this. Is like you start writing in like the previous or past tense as though like you got the answer already, and then your notes are already formatted at as you're doing it for after the fact. And like one thing I like doing a lot is using the Raku language as a calculator, because I can just type in math as normal and it all works.
I've tried that.
And I know that, yeah, you can just say like, I don't know, 25 times 4 with, and you can put like parentheses in it. I'm not exactly, I haven't used it very heavily. Oh, it also supports Unicode. So if you wanted to have not equals the not equals sign, the Unicode not equals sign, it will actually do that.
Cool.
Or like the division sign, you, I don't know how it will do it. Yeah. But yeah, I've been, and then using that in, I also wrote a shell script where it would just help me do a calculation. I was trying to do a business calculation where I was, and I'd have variable names, and I ended up writing the, in the parentheses, I'd have enters, returns, and then just a variable name with like a dollar sign, kind of like how you'd have in the shell. And it outputted every single line that I had in the enter. I had like 6 or 10 variables in this paragraph. The paragraph spanned, I don't know, like 4 lines or something like that. Maybe, yeah, something. I think it was along those lines. And I was just thinking of like what this would be in something else. It's like, it was a lot nicer. Yeah, I had like equations for the variable, like, in like one line, but when I wrote that what my output should be is like I wasn't putting all of these like, you know, string join, and it looked relatively close to what my terminal output would be. And then a later iteration I found on this was, let's write what I'm going to put into the command line, made a couple changeable variables in it, and then I can see my results, and that ended up being very nice. Ended up being nicer than the shells. They, yeah, ended up enhancing that shell script that I wrote.
So that's a raccoon calculator.
It's the Raku programming language, which I was Raku. Just using it, which I was just using as, which I'll just use as just straight up a calculator, because I'll do like, because it supports math well enough that I like, I, yeah, you can put like 25 divided by 4 and it doesn't start doing what's the word, modular fractal, the double math, like it, if it's like the double math where it's like negative 0.2 versus like minus 1, or sometimes it'll do optimized computer math where it doesn't give you the right answer. Why people will like Mathematica.
So how do you access it through in org mode then?
I'll do it in that. Sometimes I just fire up a Raku shell, but one of the biggest things I'll fire up a Raku shell for is like just just recently I was just like doing it for some math and like how much money will I have to spend on Christmas? Oh, I'm going to buy this gift. It's going to cost this much. And then I've got, so let's, I think 15 times four, 'cause it's no 60 divided by four, 'cause it was a four pack. And then times, and then I put it in parentheses. Oh, four plus like two plus two, because like of the families, each of the units. And I just started doing it that way. And I put them all in a parentheses. And then at the end, it just spit out the numbers. Like, so I could just use the parentheses without thinking about, you know, like, oh, I'm actually in a programming language. No, I just kind of wrote it like I was in algebra, not finding some special program, not finding a calculator, because it's easy for me to file up a terminal. Then I open that up. I don't have to, and it all just works. Plus, I also got like a full programming language behind it if I ever need it.
I wasn't aware that it utilizes like a kind of standard math notation rather than the Polish math notation that we use in ELISP. That's interesting because it's in the ELISP family of programming languages.
Yeah. It's like, hey, I can actually use my math knowledge. I can use the order of operations.
Yep.
I just wish that when I was in high school, they started telling me how to practically use this rather than me discover it years later when I'm out of it.
Yeah. Well, I probably better move along to attend the other talks.
All right.
So it's been great talking to you, Plasma Stripe.
Yep, you too.